From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Two Yellow Pine Coffins by Robert Sampson. Cowan flung the sow into the red dirt and threw himself on top of her. She struggled and shrieked. As the other two troopers howled encouragement, Cowan hacked at her throat with his field knife. The sow twisted free. Thrown backward, Cowan lost his knife and sprawled heavily in the dirt. He cursed and balled himself up, hugging a kicked leg. The sow galloped away, stiff legs splashing blood across the dust. At that moment, three strange Union troopers rode around the corner of the barn. The sow veered wildly away from them, plunged squealing and staggering out of sight by the spring house. Cowan struggled up on his knees to face the riders. Red dust thickly powdered his blue regulation pants and open-necked blue shirt. Suspicion and anxiety hardened his face. The leader of the horsemen clopped slowly toward the three dismounted men. "Two to hold and one to stab," he said in a slow, amused voice. "Or string her up and cut her throat. One man can't much do it alone." "That's a fact," Cowan panted. He watched the leader ease out of the saddle. He was a tall, stringy man with a lot of nose and heavy mustache scattered with white hairs. He wore a filthy captain's uniform coat and a forager cap. He said to Cowan, "Just supposing a man was thirsty, you suppose he might find a drink at the house?" "We just got here ourselves," Cowan said. He found his knife, stuffed it back into the sheath, and began beating dust from his clothing. "We might ought to go see." "I'm in agreement with that," the other said. "The name's Fosey." They exchanged nods. Fosey turned to the other two mounted men and said, "Why don't you step down, gentlemen, and see what the generous Johnnies have laid up for us in the smokehouse?" "Half dozen hams," Cowan grinned. "A world of yams. We already been there." "Fat Georgia," Fosey said. "A man just couldn't starve in Georgia." "Man shouldn't. Tomorrow being Thanksgiving Day," Cowan said. He tipped back his big head and brayed with laughter, exposing a mouthful of yellow-black teeth that must surely have given him agony at night. They walked slowly toward the house, one of them oversized two-story affairs with a lot of roof and a great many chimneys, common to the larger farms of central Georgia. The whitewash badly needed freshening. Four tall pillars suspended a narrow split shingle roof over the front entrance. Fosey inspected it critically. "We rode round the house," he said. "Saw nobody stirring." Cowan nodded. "So'd we." "What corps you from?" A careful smile bent Cowan's thick mouth. Glancing slyly at the other, he said, "This wing of Uncle Billy Sherman's army. There's a 15th Corps and there's a 17th Corps. But us'uns, we sort of kind of no corps at all. We just marching through Georgia on our own." "Kind of got lost and haven't found your way back?" Fosey said. "It's terrible hard. That's a true statement." They crossed the porch, feet clattering on the green-painted boards. Fosey opened a dusty black holster on his left side and drew out a .44 caliber Remington revolver, long as his forearm. Clicking the hammer back to full cock, he stepped to one side of the door and bunched his fist to knock. Before he touched the door, it swung open. From inside the screen, a small black woman glared at them. Age had shriveled her up, bent her over, stolen her teeth, marked her face. A white-dotted blue calico dress shrouded her bony body. A dull red Madras handkerchief covered her head. Careful fingers had tied the stuff of the handkerchief into seven points that stood up around her skull like the points of a crown. Resentment drew her face, all nose and chin, to the sharpness of a blade. She cried, high-voiced, in a lilting accent foreign to both men. "That worthless General Wheeler! First he robbed us, then them Abe Lincoln Yankees. They come and done the same. Now here you is grabbing and stealing and sniffing what's left. Miss Lillian, her child gonna starve." Fossey restored the pistol to the holster. "My compliments to Miss Lily," he said. "May we trouble you for a glass of water?" "Water in the well," she snapped, swinging the door shut. Cowan caught it in mid-swing and heaved the door back. They stepped into a wide, empty hall, 2 stories high. To the right curved an elaborate staircase, like wooden music. Directly ahead, far down the hall, double glass doors opened to a shadowy veranda. The air smelled pleasantly of floor wax and pine trees. "Old Wheeler and them Sherman Yankees sure cleaned it out," Cowan cried pleasantly, looking around. "'Pears like they didn't leave hardly nothing. But maybe we best poke around, like, see if there be damage. Miss Lily's sick, and her little baby, she's sick too. You take yourselves off. Go on." "Poor and sick and no man around," Cowan cried. "Just terrible. I best look in all the drawers. Maybe find medicine for that poor sick child." "You go," the black woman yelped. "You go," she leaped, claw-fingered at Cowan. Thrusting her carelessly away, he reached for the knob of a closed door. Fossey said sharply, "Cowan." Feet drummed rapidly across the porch. A filthy-faced trooper, wearing a ragged jacket, grinned in at them. "Cowan," he yelled. "We found digging out back by the pines. Not even all filled in. Looks like a wagon load of specie buried there." "Get started," Cowan said. "I'm coming right out." The man thundered off the porch. Cowan turned, and the woman flung herself at him again, shrieking and scratching. His eyes took on a faintly surprised expression. He slapped her casually with the back of his hand. The blow drove her back against the wall. She balanced their open mouth before sagging down on one knee. She stared fixedly at her hands against the polished floor. Fossey said in a low, hard voice, like iron become sound, "Cowan, you are under arrest." Cowan, grinning, turned, looked down the barrel of the Remington. "I am Captain Louis Fossey, 3rd Brigade, Smith's Division, 15th Corps. General Sherman's generals, field orders forbid entry into private homes, removal of property other than foodstuffs, and indignity to women." "Cowan," gone suddenly gray, whispered thinly, "Captain, I didn't mean nothing." "You're a liar and a thief," Fossey said. "A deserter and a disgrace to your unit. A damn bummer, in fact. Consider yourself under arrest and take yourself outside." Striding past the slack-faced Cowan, Fossey leaned out the door, roared, "Hamilton, Spencer!" The knife whispered faintly as it slipped from Cowan's sheath. The woman whimpered as he darted past her. He drove the knife twice into Fossey's back, grunting with the effort. The Remington exploded, blasting a ragged hole in the screen, driving a hole ringed with yellow splinters into the green porch. Fossey fell against the screen. It swung open, sprawling him onto the porch. Cowan hopped forward, clumsy in his urgency. He plunged the knife twice more in Fossey's back and snatched up the Remington. From around the side of the house ran both of Fossey's troopers. Cowan gestured wildly at them, his eyes showing white all around the pupils. "Woman in the house," he screamed. "Stab the captain!" As they crowded past him, he shot the nearest man in the back of the head. Bloody horror sprayed the door and began trickling down the screen. The body tumbled sideways, tangling Cowan's arm. The other trooper, young face shocked, spun around and got a thumb in Cowan's eye. Cowan triggered the Remington, heard the heart snap of a misfire. Yelling in fright, he beat the revolver against the trooper's face. The boy tumbled backward, clutching Cowan's throat and arm. They rolled across the porch, striking wildly at each other, dreamlike horror gripping their faces. Cowan lost a revolver and could not draw his knife. His two friends pounded across the porch and tore the men apart. Cowan struggled up, bracing his back against a pillar. Chest heaving, he gasped, "Hang on to that boy, Tucker. He's a regular. Come to hunt us down." "Be damned," Tucker said. "Seems he found us, too." The second man, heavy features masked by beard, looked glumly toward the dead men by the door. "You have to kill them? That's a hanging thing." Cowan said, "Had to, Moreland. He funned us out." Moreland sighed. His eyes slipped sideways to the prisoner and slid away again. "Now we got this poor boy here." "I'll think of something," Cowan said in a violent voice that suggested he had thought of nothing. He pressed one hand delicately around his mouth, feeling the scream of his bad teeth. "We gotta move these boys. Somebody ride up first thing he sees them laying here." "We can't use that hole around back," Moreland said. "You find any specie yet?" "We just hit wood when we heard the shooting." Cowan looked more cheerful at that, he said. "You take this young feller back round. Tucker and me will haul these dead ones out of sight." Tucker snorted. "I'm a better guard than a hauler." "Best thing you do is eat," Cowan said. "Let's get a hustle on." They hauled the bodies across the porch and around the side of the mansion and laid them in temporary concealment behind a fat holly hedge. "You're a sudden man," Tucker said sourly, inspecting the bodies. "Nobody knows but us," Cowan said, buckling on the Remington. "There's the boy." "Well, hell now," Cowan said, "the boy. These fellers, just one little bitty patrol, main body, come down on us any time." "Not this afternoon," Cowan said. "Tomorrow we be gone." They crossed the unkept lawn, touched with the fitful yellow of late-blooming dandelions. Near the pines, a rough pit, nearly 8 feet by 5, had been hacked from the lawn. Moreland stood by it, watching the young trooper slowly shovel out lumps of red clay. "Look at what we found," Moreland said. He angled one finger down at the hole. Under the red dirt showed the pale yellow of pine board. "It's a coffin," the boy said sullenly. "I can feel it under my feet." "Clean it off," Cowan said. "We gone this far. Let's finish." They uncovered not one coffin, but two. The largest about 6 feet long and narrow. The smaller one, obviously, for a child, and narrower still. Both were built of fresh yellow pine planks, neatly nailed together. The heavy plank tops contained screw holes, but no screws. Cowan and the young trooper heaved up the top of the larger coffin. Cowan knelt, his avid grin fading. The box contained only a white sheet, badly stained by mildew, and a white velvet cushion still marked by the weight of a head. The smaller coffin also contained a sheet and pillow. Tucked away under the sheet, Cowan found a faceless cloth doll with voluminous red and blue skirts. He hurled the doll back into the coffin. "Sold by God," growled. "But why did they take out the bodies?" A rill of red dust trickled into the small coffin like the fall of powdered blood. "Let's go try our luck at the house," Moreland said. A hungry look came over his face, wiping out his expression of indolent good humor. "Nice things in big houses." Tucker jerked his thumb toward the young trooper, sitting silent on the edge of the grave. "How about him?" Cowan said pleasantly. "What's your name, son?" "Hamilton. Josh Hamilton." "Well now, Josh, maybe you might be thinking to join us in our life of ease." Hamilton's eyes drifted from them. In a low, embarrassed voice, he said, "Don't think I could." "We might take your parole. You're agreeing not to be saying anything about us." Hamilton worked on some obstruction in his throat. When he got a swallow, he whispered, "Couldn't do that. Can't promise, not honorable. Can't do that." "Figured not," Cowan said. Hamilton lifted his head and set his eyes on them, a pale wondering on his face like a man finding himself lost while blackberrying. He said in a tone of remote surprise, "I got 4 little girls at home." "That's terrible hard," Cowan said. Slipping the Remington from its holster, he nodded to Moreland and Tucker. "You might just go ahead and wander up to the house and see what's to see." "We'll do that," Tucker said. They strode away, feet swishing in the grass. Cowan settled himself on the grave's edge, sitting across from Hamilton with the coffin's hollow between them. "Now, honor," he told the young man. Honor's a hard thing to get your hands on. I minded how we climbed Kennesaw Mountain these 6 months ago. Lots of us marching up that mountain so bold and fine. Lot fewer of us running back down again. Not much honor in marching up and running down. It isn't that, Hamilton said. When you're dead, Cowan said. You swell up too big for your pants, and you turn black, and there's a stink. Nobody says he was honorable. He wasn't honorable, they say. My God, get him underground. No honor in being dead is just the word to excuse you getting killed for no particular reason. I guess I just can't explain it to you anyway, Hamilton said. Guess not, Cowan said. The Remington, which had remained leveled at Hamilton while they talked, gave a sharp metallic snap. Cowan lifted the pistol and examined it with hard curiosity, open mouth exposing his foul teeth. Now see that? He cried. He smacked the side of the Remington with his hand. That's twice she wouldn't shoot you. You're not to die by this gun, youngster. Hamilton said nothing. His sweating face, gone a bloodless blue-white, bore a look of mild interest. I'll tie your hands, Cowan said. Then we'll get up to the big house, figure out what to do with you later. Them four little girls sure got themselves a lucky daddy. He found rope and loosely tied Hamilton's hands behind his back. Long shadows streaked the grass. Swallows weaved through darkened air. To the west, cold-looking gray clouds edged rose and orange, massed low against a lusterless sky. Cold day for riding tomorrow, Cowan said. But long as a man's moving, he's safe. You'll ride square into General Wheeler's hands one day, Hamilton said. Cowan shook his head, grinning. No, no. Nobody in these parts but Union men and Georgia women. He stopped abruptly to stare toward the holly hedge, then crossed, to kick among the spiny brown leaves strewing the ground. Now, why in hell they carry off them bodies? They knows we got to haul them to the graves. He turned away, setting down his feet hard, and dragged Hamilton around the house. As they stamped into the porch, a storm of flies whirled up around them. The blood patches by the door crawled back black with them. A shivering mat of insects clung to the screen door, passionately feeding, emitting a heavy metallic drone that was deeply disgusting. From the twisting swarm, a fly nearly an inch long plunged heavily against Cowan's forehead. Where touched them, a dull red smudge remained. My God, Cowan cried. This is terrible. He scrubbed his face violently with the sleeve of his coat, smearing a dark memory of blood along his temple. This is worse than Atlanta, and all them Texas dead to the front of us. Behind the screen appeared Tucker's bearded face. He stood so close that flies seemed to creep across his features, as if he too were long dead and improbably propped against the door. You'd best come look at this, Tucker said. Cowan pushed Hamilton into the great hall and followed, slashing at flies darting about his head. When the screen door slammed, a twisting uproar of insects spun around the entrance. The screen blackened as they settled again to feeding. Listen, Cowan growled. What in hell's the sense, you moving them dead troopers? Now we got to haul them all the way back. Didn't come a shout by them troopers, Tucker said. Nary touched them, nor did Moreland. I couldn't see them at the holly hedge. You looked wrong, Tucker said. You looked back of the wrong bush. But fear got into his face, twisting at his shoulders, bending his body. By God, Gowan growled, so I must have, damned if I figure how. Didn't take him and dead men don't wander, that's a fact. He shook his head, not convinced. Well, show me what you got to show me. Tucker shuffled across the hallway to a double door at the foot of the staircase. Moreland sat on the staircase, holding his rifle vertically between two big hands. Looking back over his shoulder at Cowan with an expression of frightened malice, Tucker turned the knob. This will properly delight you, he said. The door crept open, exposing a room thick with the evening shadow. Past Tucker's shoulder, Cowan saw a pallid blur, lean and tall, as a whitewashed post, seen in the dark. Before his eyes could search out details, the black woman flung herself across the entrance to bang the door shut. She shouted furiously, "Stay away! You let them be!" Tucker twisted with a curse, grabbing at her. She shrieked and clawed. Moreland bounced off the stairs to wrap his arms around her tiny body. She kicked at his legs, loudly furious. "Now ain't she totally fierce?" Moreland grinned. "Oh my, yes." He yelped as the black woman bit his hand. Pushing past them, Cowan swung open the door. Beyond lay a great hollow of a room. Through draped windows, filtered, feeble gray light defined no detail, but only emphasized the darkness. His eyes came suddenly to a focus. Before him stood a lean woman, dressed in white, arms dangling at her sides. Dark scratches marred the bloodless pallor of her hands. Next to her, erect and still, was a small girl, also in white. They stood passive, their faces without intelligence, their eyes regarding something that hung invisible in the air between them and Cowan. They did not move or speak. Breath whispered in Cowan's mouth. To the black woman he said, "What's wrong with him, Auntie?" "They're sick," she cried. "You leave them be." He advanced a single grudging step, licking his lips. "Ma'am?" he said to the woman. "Ma'am?" She seemed unaware of his presence. The chalk mask of her face glimmered in the vague light. Her right eye, he saw, stared upward from its deep socket. Her left eye angled toward the floor. The eye seemed filmed. He did not dare look at the child's eyes. Their presence so close filled him with thin sickness. A faint, frigid wind seemed to run through him. At any moment, they might extend their arms and touch him with their limp fingers. Fear jerked his body back. He found himself outside the door, heart violent in his chest. He snarled at the black woman. "They're blind, Auntie," she said, shrilly contemptuous. "My name is Lalo Hussa." Shaking off Moreland's hands, she pattered to the door. To the blank face in the shadow, she said, "We'll have us some soup, Miss Lily. You and little Rose just wait easy." She drew the door closed upon their terrible stillness. Tucker's voice grated in his mouth. "What sickness they got?" Lalo Hussa said, "Just sick. They got the fevers, like to burn my poor child up. They're just like dead. The mister, he took them to the coffins hisself. But he took them out again, not dead, only sick." "They're dead," Tucker said, not moving his lips. "I wash them," she cried. "I feed them soup. I takes care of them. They not dead." Moreland cleared his throat and shuffled his feet. Not looking at Cowan, he said, "There's still light. Let's saddle up and ride on a piece." "Where's the mister?" Cowan asked. She gave him a vicious grin. In the shadowed hall, her upturned face seemed to have no eyes. "He rode off to fight the Yankees. He come back, shoot you dead." Cowan chuckled, and to Moreland and Tucker, "Now we wouldn't want the mister to come back and find us gone, would we, boys?" "Don't give a damn for him," Moreland said, and jerked his head toward the closed door. "It's them." "Getting late," Tucker said. "Let's go. Uncle Billy's troopers ride by. We're catched coons." "And leave this place without looking?" Cowan cried. "That's a fool thing. By and by we'll go, but see what we find first. Look through the drawers. Maybe silver. Maybe something. Maybe Auntie here knows where they buried something." "They're buried no nothing." "We'll need us some candles," Moreland said. "Where's your candles, Auntie?" "My name," she said, "is Lalo Hussa." She marched off, closely followed by the hulking Moreland, who gripped his rifle across his chest like a man walking to battle. Tucker sighed and stepped off carefully across the hall. In the silence between his footsteps, they heard the muted humming of flies. At the door on the other side of the hall, Tucker hesitated, gingerly pushed it open as if it were hot. He glanced swiftly into the room and as swiftly withdrew. "Too dark," he said. "Let's be for riding, Cowan." Cowan said, "Now let me tell you something, Tucker." He crossed the hall to lay his hand on Tucker's shoulder. I had a brother once, long time ago. Maybe I still got a brother. I ain't been back to home these many years. He come down with a fever, and it burned him up. Just naturally burned him alive. You come near him, it was like coming to the stove in winter. Now that fever burnt everything out of him. Burnt his thinking clean away. Didn't know nothing. Couldn't say nothing. Sat in a chair. Had to be wiped up like he was a little baby. Had to have food spooned in his mouth. My own brother. Complete burnt up. Now you look at that woman and her child. Now, it's the same with them. Burnt up with fever. Left them blind. Just as well be dead. But they ain't dead. Just like my brother, all burnt up. Faint color touched Tucker's cheeks. Think that's what happened, for a fact? Look, just like my brother. They do look bad. That's a natural truth. The doors at the far end of the hall banged open, and Moreland stepped in holding a lighted candle in one hand, a bundle of candles in the other. He strode toward them, the rifle slung from his shoulder, his footsteps big and ringing in the hollow hallway. "Here's some light," he called. "Man can't see what he's doing." Tucker scurried to meet him. They whispered together, lighting candles and looking back towards Cowan. By this time, the hall was full of night, the air dense with shadow. Above the whispering men rose 30 feet of darkness, a towering presence peering down at them, grim and patient, examining the island of light in which they stood. Moreland and Tucker came toward Cowan, their boots making an infernal clatter on the floor. Extending a handful of candles, Moreland said, "I heard a fever making him like that." "I'm witness to it," Cowan said. "This young feller and me will take us a ramble through these rooms downstairs. You turn out upstairs." "Suits me," Tucker said. He glanced uneasily across the hall toward the room of the women. "You suppose you're standing in there in the dark? Standing, listening?" "Hell," Cowan said. "They can't do nothing else." They searched. It was a stripped house, a hollow house, an empty house. The great bare room rang with echoes. Nothing remained but echoes. Furniture gone, draperies gone, rugs rolled up, rectangles of gray dust on the floors. Squares of unfaded wallpaper showed where pictures once decorated the walls, and mirrors reflected the busy household. Cowan swore low and bitterly. He swept the candle around him, emptiness and dust, spiderwebs blurring the high corners of the room. His footsteps clattered hollowly, echoes in a dead heart. "Took it all," Cowan said, "loaded in wagons and rode it off." "The owner?" Hamilton asked. "Looks to be. Troopers leave it a mess. Maybe bust them some furniture, leave cabinets and such behind. But these folks didn't leave nothing. And you can bet they for sure left nothing buried. No silver, no gold, no rings, nor combs." Slamming the door, he slouched into the hall, holding up his fragile cone of light. The candle flame reeled in the crosstrot. Around him, shadows staggered like crazy things at dance. Upstairs, footsteps pounded along the halls, anger in the sound of them. Looking up, Cowan had the sudden impression that something dark and soft peered down at him from behind the railings of the upper hall. For an instant, he found himself unable to move. The footsteps from above cast sniggering echoes down the staircase. Then he recognized in himself the onset of night panic, that suffocation of terror that grips the sentry staring alone into the dark. He said savagely, thrusting away fear, "Sounds like the boys having no better luck than us." Doors at the far end of the hall opened. Cowan jumped, spilled candle grease across his fingers, swore with violence. Lalo Hussa entered the hall, holding a candle in one hand, and the other a steaming white pot. She vanished into a room behind the great stairway. A moment later, the unsteady glow of candles spilled into the hallway. Hamilton sniffed and remarked, "She promised to give Miss Lily some soup." From the hall above roared Moreland's voice, "Cowan, not a damn thing up here. She's been picked to the bone." "Same down here," Cowan yelled. "Best come down." "Didn't I tell you?" came Tucker's sour voice. "We could have been riding this long hour, not looking at bare walls." Lalo Hussa emerged from the room behind the stairs and bore energetically down on them. "Told you," she cried triumphantly. "Said was nothing here."
"So you said," Cowan growled.
She brushed by him and entered the room where Miss Lily and the child waited. Hamilton said, "They've been standing there in the dark, not even a candle," his voice whispered. "Blind people don't need no light," Cowan said. Moreland and Tucker thumped down the staircase toward them, their faces anxious in the candle glow. Their eyes searched. The emptiness of the house rang all around them. Lalo Hussa stepped from the dark room. In her candle's uneasy glow, they saw Miss Lily and the child following single file behind her. They moved smoothly, silently, arms at their sides, not touching each other. Their faces showed white like those evasive patches that float, ghostly and feeble, across the night surface of a swamp. Suddenly, still on the stairs, Moreland and Tucker watched the woman file by. When they vanished into the candlelit room, Moreland eased down the stairs. He said to Cowan, "Nothing left upstairs but the wallpaper. Let's go." Tucker sniffed the air. "Smell that cooking? Before we go, let's get us a cup of that soup." "I don't have no great hunger," Moreland said. "Let's saddle and go." "Come on," Tucker said, taking Moreland's arms. "We'll fill our cups first, then we ride. You coming, Cowan?"
"We'll follow behind," Cowan said.
He watched the two move away through the hollow whisperings of the hall. "Come on," he said to Hamilton, and pushed the young man towards the door of Miss Lily's room. "These women got to change their clothes. And where there's clothes, maybe there's rings and necklaces too, don't you think?"
"Robbing blind woman," Hamilton said. "That's an evil thing."
"In here," Cowan said, shoving the door open. He lifted the candle. The dim light touched the walls. They edged slowly into darkness that swallowed light and reflected nothing back. Gray slits marked the windows. Close around them, the black air rang hollowly. Some deep buried sense whispered that beyond their light drifted watching things, seeking to edge behind. Their backs cringed. On the floor ahead glimmered a whitish mass. Cold ached along Cowan's nerves. He heard Hamilton's breath harsh in his mouth. Cowan thrust out the candle. The whitish mass became a pair of mats stretched along the wall. Small pillows at the heads, sheets wadded at the feet. From nails driven into the walls dangled two white dresses, long and short. An unclean odor hung in the air. "Sleep like animals," Hamilton whispered.
"Can't be all they have," Cowan cried. "No mirrors, no shoes. Where they dress?"
He swung around, squinting into the darkness. The candle flame bobbed and shook, unstable as a frightened heart. Shadows pulsed and fled back. Near the floor gleamed eyes and pale teeth. Cowan shouted inarticulately, lunging back, fumbling for his knife. Before he located the hilt, he recognized the staring face with its big nose and heavy mustache. The jaw sagged, exposing a gray tongue. Hamilton said, "Captain Fosey!" in a voice not quite controlled. Cowan, gone pale as Fosey's face, said, "They did move him. Damn them."
Moreland said not.
"Those little women sure didn't. He sure didn't walk." Hamilton said, "There's holly leaves on his tunic. He got up on his dead legs and walked through the door and sat down to wait on us." He spoke slowly, every word shaking at the edge.
"Shut up," snarled Cowan. "Shut up, you crazy. Sniveling like a woman, and you a soldier. Dead is dead. There sits the other one."
Candlelight fell upon a second corpse, the face shattered by Cowan's shot. The body sprawled against the wall a few feet from Fosey. "Dead, by God," Cowan snarled. "Brains on his face."
"They're watching us," Hamilton said. "The dead look," Cowan said, "but damn if they see. Come on." He jerked viciously at Hamilton's arm, pushing him towards the door. Metal voice, he said. "What's two dead men, Hamilton? You've seen 1,000 stinking in the field. What's two more?" "They were good to me," Hamilton said. "Fosey and Spencer, good men." He began to cry silently in the darkness. Once out of the room, Cowan defiantly slammed the door. A yell of echoes burst around them. Dragging at Hamilton's arm, he stamped down the hall toward the lighted room under the stairs. In that room, Moreland and Tucker stood by a long wooden table. At each end blazed a 3-piece candlestick. The backs and shoulders of the watching men seemed curiously rigid, as if they had disciplined themselves to watch some disgusting thing. At the table, Miss Lily and the child bent over basins of soup. The liquid looked thin as pump water. Bits of orange and green vegetables floated in the pallid stuff. Not touching the basins with their hands, they sucked up the soup, bubbling and slobbering. Their strepsious mouths seemed unrelated to the staring emptiness of their faces. Behind them stood Lalu Hussa. She glared hate at Tucker as he lifted a tin cup and self-consciously tasted its contents. "Don't taste like nothing at all," he said. "No meat, no salt, no nothing." From the pocket of his tunic, he fumbled out a small leather bag, worked it open with a thumb. He sprinkled its contents into his cup. Lalu Hussa cried sharply, "What's that? What's that?" "Salt," Tucker said, extending the bag. "Here." She cried out a single furious syllable and slapped the bag from his hand. "Get that away." Polished hardness slipped into Tucker's face. His eyes became thorns. Placing the cup on the table, he caught Lalu Hussa by the shoulders, pushed her back against the wall. "Don't you hit at me," he said. "Don't you ever do it." Lalu Hussa wiggled furiously in his grip. Teeth flashed in her dark face. She squalled. "Help me, Miss Lily, help me, Miss Rose." Tucker shook her hard. Driving her head against the wall, she kicked and clawed at him. As Miss Lily stood up, her chair banged over. She glided away from the table with easy grace, like a dancer floating through the measures of a pavane. She did not seem to move rapidly, but before Tucker could turn, she was behind him. Her slender arms reached up. Little Rose's chair creaked back. She came pattering toward Tucker. Miss Lily placed pale hands at each side of Tucker's head, fingers touching his lower jaw. In the candlelight, the scratches on her skin showed as thin black lines. She pulled at his head. Tucker's startled face twisted into the candlelight. Tucker's neck snapped with a single hard sound. Moreland flung himself forward, clutching at Miss Lily. Tucker toppled from her hands, his legs and arms convulsing. She fell back against Moreland, and her arms reached up to encircle his neck, as if they were lovers. He stared down into her face, inches below. Moreland began screaming. Little Rose wrapped tiny arms around Moreland's leg. With no apparent effort, she tugged it from under him. Moreland plunged backward across the table. Miss Lily, still holding his neck, the table crashed over. Dishes clattered and spun, the candlesticks tumbled out their candles. Darkness leaped into the room like a black thing rearing from the floor. 2 lighted candles rolled against the wall, their flames gone small and blue. Patches of white swayed around the shouting darkness that was Moreland, agony and horror in his voice. He convulsed and heaved. The room shook as a white bundle thudded heavily against the wall. In the vague light, Cowan recognized Miss Lily's calm face. Around her body, the white dress swirled like blown mist. She stepped forward, seeming unaware that she had struck the wall with force enough to shatter her spine. Her face held no more expression than a cake of soap. As she glided toward Moreland, with her boneless flowing step, he reared erect. Grunting, with effort he heaved an indistinct blur of white above his head. In the fluttering light, the whiteness seemed somehow attached to his face. Moreland screamed, "Get it off me!" He crashed the blur against the floor. Shadows writhed within shadows. Cowan, struggling from behind the table, saw a confusion of movement, as if the dark mass that was Moreland stamped furiously upon an indistinct pale smudge. "Cowan, for God's sake!" Reaching out, Miss Lily embraced Moreland. Cowan snatched up a candle. The flame shrank to a wavering blue patch that cast no light. He could see nothing. A heavy falling shocked the room. From the blackness came a high metallic squeal, thin and terrible, as if in the darkness an owl tore apart a large mouse. Against the plank floor, feet beat furiously, then not so furiously. From the darkness, Lalo Hossa said, "That enough, Miss Lily." Cowan's candle flame slowly lengthened to clear yellow. Across the room he saw the shine of Lalo Hussa's eyes. He groped up a second candle. Hamilton's voice muttered at his ear, "Cut me loose, Cowan. Cut me loose." On the floor, quite close to Cowan's feet, flopped a whitish mass. For one terrible moment he thought that it would touch him. He lurched back, kicking a tin dish across the room, looking down at the flattened, wiggling thing that was Little Rose. Footprints smudged the white dress. The shattered body attempted to rise. It could not. It crept forward in the slow, deliberate movement he had seen in soldiers disemboweled on the field. Moments before death, bodies hollow with death, they crept towards the future, limbs moving in imitation of life, as if each movement certified that they lived and what had come upon them could be denied. From the child's distorted skull, one eye stared upward like the eye of a flatfish. Lalo Hossa knelt by the crawling thing. "Baby, baby, good little honey," she crooned. "You fine honey. You go home now." Dark fingers dipped into Tucker's salt bag. Dark fingers scattered salt into the shattered mouth. Sudden purpose gripped the crushed body. It crept slowly past, fingers scratching on the dark floor, and butting aside the door, vanished scraping and sliding down the dark hall. Lalo Hossa lifted her head to look up at Hamilton's rigid face. "It's the old way," she said. "Salt sends them to their rest." He asked in a voice of inhuman calm, "Why did you bring them back?" She laughed. "Had to," she said, "had to. They got the sickness. The mister, he laid them in their coffins hisself. Then he filled up the wagons, and he said to me, 'What's left, it's yours, Lalo Hossa. Take the house, Lalo Hossa.' But who'd leave me to keep this fine house? General Wheeler? Them white trash past the hill? So I call Miss Lily and Little Rose back the old way, the way I learned in the Caribbees. Me, just a child, so long ago. And if people came, why, here Miss Lily and her child sick in their house, and me taking care for them, but all the time in my house only, and nobody knowed." Hamilton said, "Dead? My God, dead?" in a voice like scratching rocks. "Not dead, till they laid down," she said, "but now I don't need him no more. You just go stand by your friend." "My friend," Hamilton said, "I'm his prisoner. Tied hands and all." "Then go stand away, Mr. Prisoner." She swiveled toward Cowan, showing bright teeth. "You hit my face," she said. The Remington slipped free of the holster. "Blow your damn head off," Cowan said. Pointing the revolver to Lalo Hussa's face, he hauled back the hammer. It set with a hard click, but as it did so, he saw that the cylinder had not turned. Understanding flared in him. Hamilton had twice escaped simply because the hammer had fallen on a discharge chamber. The linkage revolving the cylinder likely broke when he had dropped the pistol, struggling with Hamilton. But you could half-cock the weapon and turn the cylinder with your fingers. Lalo Hussa said, "Let the boy go. Kill me, this man." Miss Lily, standing passively by the door, glided forward, reaching toward Cowan, her hand palm up. The Remington flared and bucked, spitting out hard sound. The massive ball hurled Lalo Hossa backward, slapping her off her feet, sprawling her against the overturned table. Miss Lily's hands reached through the acrid powder haze. Her fingers at his neck felt cool and dry and hard. He felt her strength, looked past her scratched hands into her blank face. Some remote part of his mind informed him that Holly had scratched her skin as she lifted dead men from the hedge. As that picture ran behind his eyes, he clubbed the Remington hard against her head, felt bones break, saw her nose flatten, her skull deform. "The salt!" Hamilton screamed. Cowan hit her twice more, with all the despairing power of his heavy arms. The blows drove her back. Her broken face held no expression, no blood showed. She took hold of his arm and exploded with pain, the flesh crushed like an apple in a press. Howling, he smashed at her hand with the Remington. Stumbling away from her, striking wildly, he tripped over a chair, and as he struggled up, saw the leather salt bag by Lalo Haas's hand. Miss Lily wrenched the Remington from his hand. Bone from her fractured fingers projected gray-white through the skin. He snatched the salt bag from the floor. He dumped its contents into his palm. Wet, thin sounds spilled from his open mouth. Miss Lily closed both hands around his neck and lifted him straight up from the floor. Her filmed eyes peered past him. Her broken jaw hung down. As the pressure on his neck grew intolerable, he hurled the salt into her gaping mouth. He fell. The floor struck him a vicious blow. For a moment she loomed over him, a dreadful figure in white, emitting a dank, musty smell like an attic in winter. A tremor ran through her body, shaking it the way wind shakes leaves. She turned from him. In her smoothly boneless way, she slipped through the door. Her footsteps padded away down the hall. "God," he cried, "God." He was unable to stand. He knelt by Lalo Huss's body, feeling the floor turn under him, feeling the floor become a gulf into which he plunged, unprotected, unrestrained, falling forever. Hamilton asked, "Is she dead?" in a slow, impersonal voice. Cowan looked at Lalo Huss's slitted eyes, the blood on her clothing and bubbling mouth. "She's going." "You'd best cut me loose," Hamilton said. Cowan shook his head and fumbled up the Remington. His hands could hardly grip the weapon. Bringing the hammer to half-cock, he fingered a cylinder around. "I'll not be leaving you to hang me," he said. The hammer fell. The Remington snapped thinly. Cowan stared at it stupidly, then began to laugh. "Them some lucky little girls," he said. Throwing down the Remington, he drew his knife. Hamilton pushed back the door with one toe and slipped through. Outside the door, he cried out a single thick syllable. His footsteps ran away through the echoing darkness. Cowan rumbled in his throat. His mouth was one hot agony. Heaving up on unsteady legs, he braced himself, stumbled toward the door. "Can't outrun me with your hands tied," he yelled. "I won't hang." He swung back the door. Before him stood Captain Fosse and the Trooper Spencer. Their eyes did not look at him. Their mouths hung open. They stood there quite dead, and they reached out and put their hands on him. Cowan used a knife, but that did no good. He did not scream long.